Welcome back to BSA by Design, a podcast about transforming healthcare, educational, and research facilities through expert design and insight. I'm your host once again, Brian Moore, and thanks for joining us. In this episode, we're going to have a conversation about the Facility Guidelines Institute with Terry Joy, Craig Pichetti, Heather Livingston, and John Williams. The Facility Guidelines Institute, also known as their acronym FGI, is a nonprofit organization that works to develop guidelines for designing and building hospitals and other healthcare facilities. Both Terry and Craig from BSA are voting members of the FGI Health Guidelines Revision Committee, that's HGRC, and Terry's focus is on the hospital document, while Craig's is on the outpatient document. They're currently in the middle of working with 135 other multidisciplinary subject matter experts for the 2026 FGI revision cycle. Terry and Craig have also contributed as subject matter experts in the past 3 years and were members of the FGI Emergency Conditions Committee during the COVID pandemic. We thought it would be great to have Heather and John on to have a conversation about what's been going on with the FGI guidelines. First, let me introduce our guests. Heather B. Livingston, MSL, is the CEO of Facility Guidelines Institute. Prior to becoming CEO, she was the Chief Operating Officer for FGI and the Managing Editor of the Guidelines for the Design and Construction of Hospitals, Outpatient Facilities, and Residential Health Care and Support Facilities. Heather served as a Consulting Editor for FGI from 2011 through 2016 and was a Freelance Writer from 2006 through 2015. Prior to that, she was an associate editor for the American Institute of Architects, AIA, and the director of Business Week, an architectural record awards program. Her work has appeared in This Old House, Catalyst, Architectural Record, AIA Architect, and other design publications. John L. Williams is Vice President of Content and Outreach for the Facility Guidelines Institute and chair of the 2026 HGRC. John brings 30 years of experience in healthcare design and regulation to FGI. As Executive Director of Construction Review Services for Washington State Department of Health, John assures healthcare facilities are built to state licensing, federal certification, and building code requirements. In his new part-time position with FGI, John will serve as Technical Content Expert and Industry and Government Liaison, and will lead efforts to educate various groups on the importance of healthcare design standards. This position will be key to supporting FGI's mission to establish and promote consensus-based guidelines and publications advised by research to advance quality healthcare. Terry Joy is the Director of Planning at BSA Life Structures and has been with BSA for 6 years. A graduate of Indiana State University, Terry has certifications in EDAC, Emergency Nursing and Trauma Nursing, CNTCRN, and has spent over 32 years as a registered nurse, and 26 of those years have been in the clinical operations and leadership roles with Eskenazi Health and Union Hospital. At Eskenazi, Terry was the director of trauma services, prior operative services, orthopedic services, and clinical education. She has served as an education board member for the Nursing Institute for Healthcare Design for 3 years and a member of the HCD and PDC abstract review committees also over the last 3 years. Terry is a member of the subcommittees within the hospital group for this 2026 revision cycle. The subgroups include Procedure Task Group, Tool Team, Infection Prevention, and Mobile Unit Task Group. And last but certainly not least, Craig Pichetti is a principal at BSA and for the last 8 years, a healthcare architect for over 30 years. Craig is also the Austin Studio Director and a member of the BSA Board of Directors. He holds ACHA, EDAC certifications, and has been past chair and co-chair of the AIA Austin Academy of Architecture for Health. Craig is an ACHA preparatory certification instructor at several healthcare conferences. He graduated from Texas A&M with a Bachelor of Environmental Design. He has been involved in the State of Texas Hospital and ASC Licensing Rules Revision Committees, Facility Guidelines Institute, HGRC Topic Group, Rural Health, and was the co-chair of the FGI Emergency Conditions Committee for small and or rural hospitals. Now that we've set the table with the background of our excellent guest today, let's move on to our conversation. Thanks for joining me on the show, everyone. We're honored to have Heather Livingston and John Williams from Facility Guidelines Institute with us, as well as Terry Joy and Craig Pichetti.
from BSA to talk all things FGI guidelines. Heather and John, let's start with the two of you. Can you talk a little bit about what FGI does and what the FGI guidelines are?
Sure. I'm a little bit of a history nerd, so do you mind with if we start up with a little history to start?
Not at all. If you can see my George Washington picture behind me, I was a history major, so
excellent. By all means. Excellent. So the guidelines have been around in some form for around 75 years. They've gone by a number of different names. Many people have, I think, still referred to them as the AIA guidelines, but they are the FGI guidelines now. They started back in the 1940s, and that was a period of time in our history when the federal government was really trying to imagine how to increase hospital capacity in the country. And at the same time, when they increased capacity, make sure that those buildings were constructed in a way that supported safe and healthy care. The first guidelines, and we called them standards back then, were a development that kind of grew out of the Hill-Burton Act. And that's probably a topic for another time, but it was a sweeping set of legislation that was ultimately responsible for construction of a lot of the hospitals that we see still around the country today. So as hospitals became more complex over the coming decades, those standards developed as well. Ultimately, in the 1980s, the feds realized that states were doing similar kinds of standard developments inside of their own state. So at that point, rather than duplicating what states were doing, feds stopped funding the guidelines and stopped publishing the guidelines. So one of the challenges with code development, of course, is trying to keep the codes crisp and responsive to the changing risk and really just the different way that we continue to build buildings. And this takes time, and states don't always keep up. So we found ourselves in one of those situations in the mid-80s. While the guidelines were continually being updated, many states had not done the same. So when the Fed stopped publishing the guidelines, we were kind of left with a patchwork of different requirements all across the country. So some folks realized at that point that, first of all, you know, there was value of consistency across the country from state to state. And really, secondly, we're all better together. It really takes a broad multidisciplinary group working from all sides of the country in all different, you know, disciplines to really get that breadth and depth of understanding of how we build these really complex structures we call hospitals and residential care. So at that point, a group of folks approached the federal government and said, hey, can we take these guidelines and continue to develop those? And that's when the Health Guidelines Revision Committee was really formed. The product that they produced was originally published by AIA, which is why many people still call them the AIA guidelines. But in 1998, the Facility Guidelines Institute was formed. And Heather, this is really where you know a whole lot more about the FGI than I do.
Thanks, John. A really great overview and history there. One of the things that I always enjoy hearing about is actually how FGI came to be. And, you know, John mentioned 1984. It was a whole era of deregulation, as you recall. And so these documents that had been around since 1947, because certain requirements had sunsetted in the government and the funding wasn't tied to it as much anymore, that was why the federal government decided that they didn't want to continue updating these documents. But the people who were designing healthcare facilities saw the real value of them. And so some of FGI's founders, Doug Erickson, Armin Burgun, and Joe Sprague, actually went down to Congress and testified and basically said, we need these. We need this information. If you're not going to do it, will you allow us to take over it and continue creating these documents on a regular cycle? And so that's really the genesis of FGI. Even for 1998, we already had those core folks in place who were advocating for healthcare design to make sure that designers and facilities have this important guidance on creating safe facilities.
I wanted to hone in a little bit about the HGRC. And can you tell us a little bit more about the revision process and where we are in the revision process today?
Sure. The HGRC, we love our acronyms, stands for the Health Guidelines Revision Committee. So every 4 years, we form a new one of these committees to consider changes to the next edition of the documents. It's still a multidisciplinary committee. We haven't lost that sort of sensibility. And today it's around 140 people with architects, clinicians, owners, engineers, researchers, AHJs like myself, all with decades of experience, all with this deep interest and passion for the physical environment inside of healthcare. These folks, when we gather them together, embark on this four-year quest or odyssey, if you will, in making these documents the minimum standard for healthcare facilities. The whole process itself is kind of straightforward. We start with the current document and we put out an invitation far and wide for any proposed changes. And that request is open to anyone. You don't have to be on the committee. You don't have to be a member of anything. You don't have to pay to submit a change. You just have to have an idea. And that's called our proposal period. And at the end of that period, the HGRC takes all of those suggestions and considers the impact, the benefit, the cost of each of those. And ultimately what they do is they vote on whether those changes have merit. If a proposal meets that test and it moves on, we incorporate that into the first draft. That's a draft that we pull together with all of the proposals in one document, and we publish that. And then we go out for kind of a second call. And that's our comment phase, where we open that draft up to the public, and anyone, again, can comment on the proposed changes. And this is really kind of where we are today. We collect those comments. After we get all of those, we collect them and we put them before the HGRC, who passes them through that same level of scrutiny. And ultimately, they'll vote on those comments again. And that's the basis of the final draft. So like I said, that's where we are today. But the trick in the comment period is that we're only accepting comments on the proposed changes that are in the draft.
I was just clarifying that it's the changes that have already been approved by the HGRC that people are invited to comment on. So, to John's point, it's not the time to recommend new changes. We're strictly looking at what's already been approved and making sure that it is appropriate, that we've hit the right balance between minimum requirement, and taking care of the patients and the staff and cost. We try to balance all three of those. And sometimes we get it right, sometimes we don't. And that's what this period is for.
So ultimately, those final comments are incorporated into the final draft. That passes before the committee one last time for a final vote. And if it passes muster, it goes on to be the next edition of the code.
Very democratic process, it sounds like. And when does the public comment period end? I know that's part of the reason we're having you on right now is because we're in the middle of it. But what's the deadline?
September 30th. So we're open right now. And if folks are interested, you can go to our online proposal platform or comment platform at www.fgiguidelines.net. And all you have to do is sign up for a free account, which allows you to view, to comment, and review any of that modified text in the current draft.
Excellent. And I'll drop a link in the show notes to the website as well so that people can access it from the podcast itself. What is the scope of the guidelines?
Well, the scope is kind of unique. It's about the built environment, but it doesn't cover some of the risks that other codes cover. So it doesn't cover egress or fire safety issues like the life safety code, doesn't cover structural issues or seismic constructability issues like the building code. Our focus is purely on the functional safety that's related to the very particular needs of health and residential care facilities. Like, how big does an operating room need to be? Do you need a scrub sink outside of that operating room? These are things that don't show up in the building code or other codes, but are reflected in the FGI. And these are written to be minimum standards, not maximum standards. So you can always go above and beyond those codes when you're designing, but they do set that baseline for minimums.
I wanted to ask, I understand there's been some recent developments around copyright. Can either of you share some details on that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. We'd be happy to. We and other standards development organizations have been running up against some issues around copyright. Standards development is an extremely lengthy and expensive process. In the past, copyright protections were very well understood, and we had a strong history of being able to rely on those copyright protections. In the current political and legal environment, we're seeing a shift and a lessening of those protections. As courts are ruling the codes are open to fair use. Basically, they believe that the value of the codes to the public good outweighs any protections that we have as the creator and copywriter of these codes. And not just FGI, there are other organizations as well. But these arguments are being put forth by organizations who claim that the codes should be free. And based on that claim, they're taking protected content of organizations like FGI, NFPA, ICC, and others as well. And they're using this protected content to sell their tools without entering into any sort of a licensing agreement. So what this ultimately means is that they're making a lot of money off of the backs of these other organizations that are investing in creating these documents over time. So they're doing that without any contribution to our future. So for a small nonprofit like FGI, that's tough. And that is a real threat. That's a big reason why we've made a decision to make some changes in our 2026 documents. So if you've seen the draft, you've noticed that there's no longer appendix attached to the guidelines. Will be called the FGI facility code in the future. And that's a big part of it. The way the courts are delivering their judgments, they're making it very clear that things that are extra are still protected by copyright. So anything that is a creative piece. So for example, in the what we call the front matter, we have a list of major updates and revisions, essays that outline all of that. That's all considered protected content. And that's why you won't find it on some of these other sites that have taken it, because they understand that courts will protect that. Because appendices are not minimum, they're also considered to be protected. And so we're taking that information. And we don't want to get rid of it because it's very valuable information, but we're very concerned about primarily others accessing this content, using it for their products without any sort of an agreement that allows us to be sure that it's accurate and complete. That's really right. The biggest concern. The financial issues it's a consideration for us. Certainly, we need to make sure that we can continue updating these documents every 4 years. But our primary concern is making sure that you as designers have accurate and complete information. And if we don't have a licensing agreement with these organizations, we can't be sure that it is.
So then what is the future of getting interpretations?
Well, all of this is still evolving. We're working through issues, but what we believe is that for 2026, we're going to have a free code. We're going to put out a basic version of the code that's going to be freely accessible. Right now, we have a read-only document. This is going to be complete access. There's not going to be a limited number of page views per month. So we'll have a free version. In order to get some additional functionality on the website and some tools such as access to interpretations, including the ability to request a formal interpretation, you would need to have a paid license. So you could get that through a more robust license on our website that would provide you some additional tools, or through what we're creating as a handbook for the 2026 edition. Either one of those would allow designers, AHJs, owners to request and access interpretations.
I wanted to pivot a little bit to some language as you guys are working through these documents. Is there any useful language considerations to be made when writing or evaluating proposals?
Oh, definitely. My background is I was formerly the managing editor of the guidelines. So I can tell you we're all very particular. And I'm sure Terry and Craig are probably laughing right now as well, because we've all had conversations about what is the meaning of shall be provided, for example, or when provided. So yeah, we do get very particular when it comes to guidelines language. But when you see something like, where provided or when provided, it basically means that you don't have to do this. You don't have to create this space. For example, if it were trying to think of a new one that we might have introduced. Oh, we have a discharged patient lounge that is in the draft. So if you are to provide a discharged patient lounge in a hospital, then you need to follow XXX, right? You need to have these things. But it's up to the facility to decide whether or not they need the space. So that's what that where provided or when provided language is. We also have lots of location terminology specific. So I'm sure many of you are used to seeing terms like directly accessible, immediately accessible, readily accessible. I probably scratch your heads and wonder what's that about and how to determine those. But we define all right. of those in the glossary under location terminology.
You're speaking my language because, and I know TJ has been in meetings with me when I, as a communications person, my trademark is words matter. So the way you word things does have a massive impact. Thank you both for setting up such a wonderful understanding of FGI and the guidelines. I want to turn to Craig and Terry for a little bit and specifically talk about outpatient and hospital guidelines and those proposed revisions. So let's start with highlighting some revisions affecting more than one of the documents. Are there any changes to the transport unit chapter, Craig?
There are actually several overlapping that span several of the documents. Transport is one of those. That section has actually been moved in the document and relabeled a little bit and renamed a little bit and tweaked. Now there's more of a focus on the built environment, porting the unit, and less on the unit itself. There's a distinction between the site requirements from the mobile unit requirements. That includes the utilities, the access, the connection to the host facility where the unit resides. And there's actually an elimination of the requirement for the low-level diagnostic-only mobile unit, so it's no longer subject to the requirements. And there's more of a focus on the Class 2 and Class 3 mobile units with more of a distinction between the medical and imaging units. And the Class 2 medical is the procedure room, and the Class 3 medical is an operating room. The units will need to meet the requirements based on the clinical services provided. And the sterile processing units themselves have been simplified. There were a lot of requirements around those just to basically have a minimum requirement, two-room sterile processing facility.
And Heather, I did catch the language there specifically based on clinical services provided. So
all goes back to the functional program.
Right. And I didn't mean to pivot away and say that, John, Heather, if you have anything to add to any of these comments, you're more than welcome to chime in.
Yeah, I would totally encourage to add anything I say, especially if I'm a little bit misstated.
Oh, no, Craig, you are absolutely right. I mean, I think that reflects a sensibility that you see in the guidelines a lot. You were talking about the difference between Class 1 units and Class 3. It's all about risk to the patient. And as the risk goes up, you know, we look for built environment and physical requirements to go up as well.
Well, Terry, let's get you involved in the conversation a little bit. Somebody coming from the outside, I don't know what this term means. What is wateridge and what are some of the wateridge concerns?
So I'm a part of the infection prevention group, and there was a lot of discussion about risk to patients for water that may lay in a pipe and not necessarily move, like for instance, in a shower that's not used, or the automatic sinks. Like if an automatic sink has not been used for a period of time, then that water sits and can develop a biofilm. There was a lot of discussion with the plumbing team, and there are lots of expert subgroups throughout, which are really helpful. This is my first cycle, so I'm still learning and still feel very like wide-eyed and green, but kind of taking it all in. But just making sure that the length of time that water sits in a pipe and or travels through the system, and that there are flushing parameters in place to minimize the risk of infection. Legionella is a common organism that you may find, and we want to minimize that risk to the patient.
And Brian, words are important. It's our concerns are around water age, so there's no space in that word, not waterage, water age.
Right. I mean, there should be a space in that word.
Oh, yeah, there is a space in that word.
water age, not right. Waterage. That's why I was so confused. So you're flushing the water lines to prevent water age from settling in some of these locations, right? Essentially. So, Craig, how about any changes to clinical room types required for a facility?
Yeah, so kind of back to what John was saying earlier about the program, the functional program. There's some language that's been added in the common elements around determining the type of room and the number of room based on the owner and clinical team's requirements that have been developed during that process. So it's not a prescribed, you got to have this and that this number. It's now left up to the team and determining exactly what's needed.
And then are there any proposed changes to the tables?
Yeah, so there's actually some really great, the new table is really pretty awesome. It's very easy to use in terms of the class one, class two, and class three imaging rooms, along with all the exam, treatment, procedure, and operating room charts. They've now have a very nice document that builds off the old one. The old one had some basic room classifications, like if you're talking about, you know, restricted, unrestricted, and that sort of concept. This even expands on that. This the chart expands itself and touches on finishes, floor base, wall, and ceiling finishes. It also touches on minimum clearance requirements and minimum square footage requirements for specific rooms. So it's actually kind of a one-stop shop for really a lot of information. So I was really happy with the way that those tables have really impacted both the documents.
So then, Craig, specific to the outpatient document, which I'm told is now called the FGI Facility Code for Outpatient Settings, what are some of the new revisions and are there any new chapters?
Yeah, actually, there are some new chapters and some things that have been shuffled around a little bit. One of the chapters that was added was actually a short stay center chapter. It's going to be chapter 15. It's really intended to be a center that serves an ambulatory surgery center. So after patients have been discharged from an ASC, they can go to one of these facilities. They're intended for not more than 16 individuals, maximum length of stay of 72 hours in absence of any local or state requirement that dictates that length of stay. These rooms are intended to be single occupancy rooms with windows, minimum of 120 square feet. They have support services for patients and staff, you know, provided, including, you know, a minimum nourishment all the way to an on-site kitchen or a warming serving kitchen. Intended to be flexible to the, you know, the scale of the facility. It should address some of the needs out there nicely. Another chapter is the sleep disorders chapter. That's chapter 16, and those are facilities where patients are tested for sleep disorders. In that chapter, they talk about a need to assess requirements for user control of their environment, including the temperature, lighting, sound, and privacy in their space. You have information on the sleep testing room size, single occupancy rooms, minimum of 120 square feet, with toilet requirements readily accessible to the patient's sleeping room. And then you also have the ability to share with a ratio of one per every three sleep rooms. And then there's some specifications around the support, including the control room itself that monitors the sleep room and the ability to have remote or direct observation of those rooms.
And Craig, can I just jump in and say here that I'm so excited about this one. For years, we've been building these sleep centers, and the only thing that we had to shoehorn those types of facilities into is just your regular old exam room requirements. Yeah. And if you imagine an exam room and you push a bed into it, there's not a lot of room left over to do anything. So you're always working outside of that guideline. I mean, we can always allow, you know, we always allow people to go up, but this is a great look at something that we encounter, you know, every year.
Tough to test for sleep disorders in an environment that is not very comfortable or induces that, right?
Absolutely. I was going to touch on the outpatient behavioral health crisis center. That's in now chapter 12. That was actually a relocated chapter. It was originally in the emergency department chapter, the freestanding emergency, and now it's got its own new chapter. And this one is really about, you know, behavioral mental health crisis centers that are a part of a freestanding emergency care facility, physically separated from a hospital, providing emergency services 24/7 and receive patients arriving by ambulance. It also combines the community-based behavioral crisis center for treatment of patients with behavioral health crisis have been medically released and are cleared prior to or upon arrival at the facility. These particular facilities have some additional requirements with the combination of the community-based. There's a prescription now for area of the intake room itself. It talks about if you have an exam room, it's where provided for the community-based. Gives you some information about that now. And it talks about a MALU room for group room, basically, for the community base that talks about minimum 80 square feet per patient for those areas. That is also a change.
And if I can just add a little bit, the MALU, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is meant to be an open space. Brian, I see your hand.
Yeah, I raised my hand.
Yeah, it's an open space where people can be with each other. The 80 square foot per space is to make sure that the room is large enough for the people who will be, you know, seeking respite basically in that space. But it's so that they're not, you know, in a room with the door shut by themselves. This way they have an opportunity to, you know, provide some self comfort, to be in a relaxing environment where they can go get up and go grab a snack if they need to. They can go grab some water. They can go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
You know, they're not feeling as though their bodily actions are limited. So it really promotes calmness and self-care. One thing I also want to say is that this now means that we have two outpatient behavioral mental health chapters. So like Craig mentioned, this was previously in the freestanding ED chapter, and it was honestly kind of hard to find. So moving it out into its own chapter makes a lot of sense. But we have the specific requirements for outpatient behavioral mental health facilities, the broader requirements in chapter 2.11. And as Craig said, this is chapter 2.12 now, specific requirements for behavioral health crisis centers, whether it's a community-based or attached to a FSCD. So really about this.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense considering the emphasis that has been put on behavioral mental health over the past several years. Craig, I did want to ask one more in terms of revisions about clean supply room language. And has there been any modifications to that?
Yeah, so now if you go into the common elements, you'll see that they've added area onto the end of the clean workroom or supply room. It now says room/area. And the idea is to leave it up to the infection control risk assessment and the functional program to determine if the clean room needs to be a room or it can just be an alcove or an area. There's still the requirement, obviously, to have it physically separated from a soiled area. And then if the determination is made that it needs to be in an enclosed room, it will be subject to the pressurization requirements of ASHRAE 170.
Terry, let's come back to you for a little bit. Specific to the hospital document, which I told is now the FGI facility code for hospitals, what are some of the new proposals and are there any new chapters being proposed there? I understand there's some new proposals specific to rural emergency hospitals in the critical access hospital chapter.
Yeah, CMS came out with a new designation for rural emergency hospitals within the realm of critical access, which decreases some of the services, but allows still for rural areas to have an emergency department and also an area where patients can stay for a period of 24 hours. So making that distinction and what those requirements are to kind of match the CMS guideline, I think has been a really good addition to that.
And then what are some of the additional revisions to this document that you'd like to highlight?
My favorite one is the procedure and OR room classification. I think that's been the most robust. I think Jonathan's like, yay. It's been the most robust discussion. And really the goal is to figure out what procedures can be performed in what areas, whether it's an operating room, a class 2 imaging suite, which is typically a cath lab, or an interventional radiology suite. And I think there was a lot of discussion around the term invasive and invasiveness and kind of what that means and the risk to the patient. So we've had a subgroup that has worked a lot on that. It's been a really great experience for me learning those things about what kind of the interpretation from the architectural side. And then I was a previous OR director, so understanding how that applies to the regulatory side. And I think that revision will be really powerful. There's also a white paper that is being developed and then some additional tools. So as Heather said, this is going to be code and it's going to be minimum, but we also felt like since there was so much discussion And this is such a high risk area that we wanted to provide some guidance of how to. A team has created a white paper, and there's also a tool team. So there are four of us on a tool team, and three of us are clinicians, and really trying to match that clinician language with the building language so that when you're working with user groups, it's easier and everybody kind of understands kind of those similar comments. A few other things that just to highlight really quickly, emergency entrance signage and directional signage. There's been some clarifications that that needs to be very clear because you don't want to add time to a critical patient trying to get the services they need. And really, what does the ambulance entrance and the walk-in entrance look like? And then one additional one I'll highlight is typically with throughput and how the healthcare system is in the United States right now, is you will have patients, you need beds. You'll have patients waiting in an emergency department and boarding, needing inpatient beds. You will have patients in the inpatient unit waiting to be discharged home, or they're discharged, but they're waiting for someone to take them to their next destination, whether that be home, an acute rehab, or to extended care. What happens, because the clinicians are very good at workarounds, we figure out a room somewhere that's empty in a hospital and put a nurse in there or a waiting space, and we'll put those patients there. And I think what has been discovered is that we want to provide some guidance from a safety perspective. If you're going to do that, consider these things in those areas, because there are patients that really do still need some level of monitoring and some level of, if they needed help, that we had the appropriate environment. So that was a really great discussion. It made all of us feel better that everyone was doing this. And then it made us all not feel better that maybe we could do this better. So that was a really great discussion about how to provide a safer environment for the patients that are waiting to be discharged.
Heather and John, let's get you back in the conversation. Are there any updates to the residential document that's now called the FGI Facility Code for Residential Care and Support Settings?
Yeah, there are actually a fair number of updates that happened this cycle. I think it's important to mention that one of the most significant was related to an effort to strengthen the requirements and provide better clarity around the minimum clear floor area and clearances that are needed for these spaces. We had an AHJ group get together and help evaluate where the language might be a little squishy, shall we say, you know, and they worked to tighten it up. So you should see a fair amount of that in the draft. Of course, it's always an ongoing process, but we believe that there's a lot more clarity around that in the draft now than we've had previously. Regarding the particular facility types, in the 2022 edition, the nursing home chapter had some information added on patient dialysis. It was really just to support some dialysis training for residents, you know, who are going to be doing this on their own. But the draft of the 2026 code features expanded dialysis requirements. And this was done in order to provide some more support to residents who are in, they've got acute renal injury, they might have ESRD. So there are some new requirements around that, as well as plumbing requirements for water distribution for hemodialysis. So that's a new change. Also, some of the requirements that were in the last edition to accommodate peritoneal dialysis have now been moved up to the common elements chapter. So they don't just live in nursing homes anymore. And that was done in order to make sure that people looking at other facility types also had ready access to this information. So those are big changes there. And, you know, Terry and Craig, you guys both worked on the Emergency Conditions Committee. And I think that you'll probably remember that one of the big things that was discussed in the residential book was, is this the time to make resident rooms single resident, you know, not have four-door room in renovations or a two-door room? And that's really the biggest change that's come forward from that document, is that you will now see in nursing homes in the draft a requirement that 80% of those rooms need to be single resident. So that's huge. That's a sea change, quite honestly. There's an allowance to have 20% of resident rooms accommodate two patients. And honestly, that's primarily in recognition of the fact that, one, some people just don't want to be alone. But also there might be times when you have a husband and wife or siblings who want a room together. And so they didn't want to discourage making those types of accommodations. So 80-20 is the percentage that's in the draft. There's a provision to allow that to be modified based on individual needs of the community, of the facility type, et cetera, when approved by an authority having jurisdiction. So that change is actually not just in nursing homes, but you'll also find it in assisted living facilities, long-term residential substance abuse treatment facilities, and settings for individuals with intellectual and or developmental disabilities. Other facility types, there are modifications to room sizes. And as I referenced before, they're really mostly around clarifying what the clearances need to be around the bed. These changes are fairly minor, but they can be found in AL chapter. The requirements for individuals of size, which is in the common elements chapter, substance abuse, and the IIDD chapter as well.
John, do you have anything to add there?
No, I think Heather has covered it really, really well. Some of those conceptual changes are big, and all of the ones that both Craig and Terry mentioned and Heather are open for comment right now. We want to hear everyone's ideas, thoughts. If you have data to support or challenge those changes, this is your time to log into our comment site and make those comments.
Excellent. And just a reminder for everybody, that's September 30th of 2024 here. Well, I'd like to thank you all for joining me. This has been such a robust conversation. I can tell the effort and amount of thought and care that's gone into the efforts that you're making with all these documents and revisions. So I applaud you all.
Hey, Brian, if you don't mind, could I just add a little bit more about
Absolutely.
The handbook? I want to be sure that everybody understands that, you know, we didn't just move the appendix over to the handbook just because we're trying to protect that content. We also have talked about this for a long time, and we're so excited about this opportunity to be able to provide extra information and tools, things that people have asked us for a number of years, like diagrams. We can't put a diagram in a code, otherwise everybody is going to design to that diagram. So we're going to be able to explain some of the concepts that we've had difficulty doing in a minimum standard before. So we're really excited. There's all sorts of new information that's currently under development, as well as some tools. And so we're very thrilled that we're actually going to be able to provide a lot more guidance to users.
And not just one-time guidance. The whole plan for the handbook is for it to be continually updated on a more frequent cycle than every 4 years. So you'll be getting the freshest information, the freshest advice and concepts out there.
More living and breathing, if you will, right?
Exactly.
Well, thank you guys again for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. This has been fun.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us on.
Thanks, everyone.
We appreciate the opportunity.
Great conversation there. And special thanks to our guests, Heather Livingston and John Williams from FGI, for joining us on BSA by Design, as well as our very own Terry Joy and Craig Pichetti. There's a link in the show notes to the FGI Guidelines Institute. If you're interested in learning more about how the experts at BSA Life Structures can best serve you, we encourage you to visit our website at bsalifestructures.com. There's a link in the show notes to contact us for more information. You can subscribe to BSA by Design wherever you get your podcasts, from Apple to YouTube Music and Spotify. And we've got new content to share all the time, so be sure to follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and X. That's going to do it for this episode. Join us again next time on BSA by Design.